Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Wildberg, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have a great guest. I'm talking about Dr. Stephen Nagy, who is a professor at the International Christian University in Tokyo. I got that right, didn't I? Well, so, you know, Stephen's, he's an American. Canadian? Oh, well, I mean, honorary American.
51st state.
Yeah, 51st state. That's right. These are trying times for the U.S. and Canada. Normally, we're, you know, almost indistinguishable. Like, right, you give us some of our best actors, and we didn't even know they were Canadian. So, welcome to NucleCast. I thought one of the great reasons I wanted to have you on is from somebody who is a fellow North American, how about that, who can look at, you know, and you sit in a faculty position in Japan and you write on strategic issues. You got a new book coming out later this year. And for somebody looking sort of from a Western perspective, understanding how the Japanese deal with the world around them and this competition between the United States and China and the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Philippines are all sitting here saying, oh man, this is, you know, we're about to be in a more difficult world. And so I thought you'd be great to have on to talk about that and sort of give us a perspective, because we recently had a Japanese scholar on to give us a take on the Japanese perspective. So, you know, juxtaposing your view and his view and how everybody sees themselves would be sort of a great podcast. So with that in mind, let me just ask you to sort of kick us off by giving us a sense of how you think the Japanese are looking at the world and looking at the strategic environment, and how are they trying to sort of position themselves to be successful in it and to deal with this, you know, what they may or may not see as sort of a fight between the U.S. and the Chinese.
So thanks very much, Adam, and it's really great to be here. So let me just give you some perspective. So I've been living and working and doing research in this region for 27 years. So more than half my life, I speak a few of the languages. So when I look at the region, I'm not really looking at it just from a Canadian or North American point of view. I've spent significant amount of times in Japan, in China, in Southeast Asia, living and working. So I look at the region in a really integrated way. And I think your question is how does Japan look at the region? And it looks at the region through $380 billion of bilateral trade with China this year. Mm-hmm. I said that right, $380 billion. This is despite the security challenges. Despite, you know, alignment of China and Russia on the Ukraine war, despite, you know, years of China facilitating North Korea's weapons of mass destruction acquisition. So they are saying to themselves, we have this big trading partner. There's no future economic sustainability without China. But at the same time, it's a real security challenge. This is what and how Japan sees the world, and this is kind of the needle that they have to thread. But Japan's predicament is also representative of the South Koreans, the Southeast Asians, frankly, Taiwan, Australia, is that their economies are so intertwined with the Chinese economy that it's difficult to make the same kinds of security choices and to see China in the same strategic way that, let's say, Canada or the United States would, because we're so far away. So sometimes the expression is that the U.S. and Canada have the luxury of geography, but the Japanese and all their all China's neighbors have the tyranny of geography, right?
Yeah.
China's close, but it also has it's kind of this friends with benefits kind of relationship. And again, that $380 billion is a big benefit for Japan. And that is really representative of the whole region.
So for the Japanese, who, you know, their recovery from World War II was built on their ability to modernize their economy, to expand trade. So they've got this ingrained in, you know, really three generations of Japanese. So it's certainly understandable that they're deeply concerned about trade, as would be the South Koreans and others. How do they sort of weigh and evaluate the security challenges and concerns versus the economic trade and benefits? Are they looking to shift production from China to other Southeast Asian nations, or, you know, other parts of the world? Are they looking to mitigate that dependence on China, or are they just saying, well, let's just hope that nothing goes wrong? How are they handling it?
So there's been a couple different strategies. So they used to have this idea of China plus one. And the idea is that, you know, they'd concentrate their manufacturing center in China. And that was for not only building stuff in China for Chinese, but also for global export. But that model, I think, has changed. So now we see, you know, a growing production network in Southeast Asia and India, where India is the biggest recipient of Japanese overseas development aid for the past 20 years. And Japan is thinking about how to build other hubs where they can produce things for global export and closer to consumers, right? So in Southeast Asia, the things made there are for Southeast Asians. The things made in India are for Indians. The things made in Central Europe are for Central Europeans or Europeans. So this is another strategy. The dirty secret is, you know what? The Chinese are moving out of China as well. So you may want to run away from China, but you're going to run back into China, because the Chinese businesses as well are facing a lot of the same pressures: increased costs, more government oversight, domestic laws being adopted in China, such as national intelligence law, cybersecurity law, and a suite of national security laws since the 2020 meeting in October, 2022 meeting in October, where national security basically was written into every aspect of Chinese policy. So even Chinese businesses are leaving China because it's become less attractive. So it's an interesting way to be seeing the region, as Japan's leaving, South Korea's leaving, but they are now transforming their domestic footprint in China to make things in China by Chinese for Chinese with Japanese technologies or South Korean technologies, especially in low value products. Those dual use items, things that can be used for something called civil military fusion, and I think your audience members probably will know this a lot. Those are being now brought back to Japan or moved to what they call friendshoring, right? Going to places that are much more reliable in terms of a partner. So semiconductors is a good example of this. But other technologies that can be used to, modernize the PLA are being removed from the Chinese market, because, again, there's great concerns of, you know, what is the trajectory of the modernization process of the People's Liberation Army and how this will be deployed in the region.
So for the Japanese, are they concerned about a potential fight over Taiwan between China and the U.S.? And if they are, what are they thinking about it? And what role do they think they might play?
Good. Great question. So just to give your listeners some insight, we think if there was a conflict across the Taiwan Strait, it would put a punch in the global economy of about 10% of the global GDP. So between 8 and 10 trillion US dollars. So it's not insignificant, right? And if there was a conflict across the Taiwan Strait, basically all the supply chains would break down. We'd see a massive inflation, inflation that would make the inflation of the COVID pandemic look rather low. So it is a really, really big issue for the Japanese. The sea lines of communication that go in and around Taiwan ferry about 2.3 trillion US dollars of goods and a lot of, you know, existential energy resources for the Japanese. So the Japanese are looking at Taiwan and saying, how can we prevent a conflict from emerging? How can we ensure that peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait remains as is? And how can they prevent a conflict from happening? So their concern is a conflict between the United States and China over Taiwan would fundamentally destroy the region's economy. And of course, for a country like Japan that is a trading country that has its, you know, manufacturing footprint throughout the region, this would be fundamentally devastating for the Japanese economy, but also the South Korean and many other economies. So they're worried. How do they think about working with the United States? Well, it'll depend on the scenario. So if there's a blockade, what would the Japanese do? If there was a kinetic conflict, what would the Japanese do? How would they coordinate resources is a big question. And I think most of us, when we're looking at the potential scenarios that involve a Taiwan contingency, that's what they call it here. The worst case scenario is a full out kinetic conflict in which the Chinese also have to attack bases in Okinawa and probably bases in the Philippines to cut off supply chains supporting U.S. efforts to defend Taiwan. So where would Japan be in that equation? Would they, you know, help rebuild the airports to ensure that the U.S. can still ferry resources to the region? That is one option. Or do they increase their deterrence capabilities through deployment of missile systems within the region? And we're already seeing that. The peripheral islands in the Japanese archipelago, Yonaguni and others, have missile systems that are meant to defend Japan, but arguably they could extend into Taiwan airspace. Drones is another area that they're thinking about in terms of what is the place for drones in a conflict. Do they flood the airspace with drones that, you know, something like the Independence Day movie with all the spaceships coming in? They're cheap, replaceable, but they can add damage. That's the kind of things that I think the Japanese are thinking alongside their American counterparts. And watching the Ukrainians fight the Russians on the Ukrainian front has shown, you know, the wisdom of drones and bolstering drone capabilities and using them both in terms of surveillance, but also in terms of combat. So there's a lot of different things the Japanese are thinking about. But most importantly, they're thinking about just peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, strong diplomatic coordination with like-minded partners, and ensuring a conflict doesn't emerge.
So do you think that for the Japanese, you know, we have a friend of Nuclecast, General Imbam Chan, retired Korean general, and we've talked about the Korean fear of returning to a sort of a subservient position to China that Korea was in, you know, in past centuries, and that the Koreans don't want to be there ever again. And so not only are nuclear weapons useful in deterring North Korea, but that there's utility in preventing South Korea from ever being in the similar position that they were in the past. Do the Japanese have any sort of similar fears or concerns? Or do they say, well, we're an island nation, you know, past Chinese attempts, you know, to invade Japan have failed. You know, the weather took care of us in the past, so therefore we can count on the weather again. Or is there sort of a different take on that? And is there, you know, the current government that said, you know, we may need to discuss, you know, the nuclear weapons in a way that they've never, you know, said publicly. So can you kind of give me an idea of how they're thinking on these issues?
So you're right about South Korea. There are very active discussions about acquiring a nuclear deterrent. It's a nuclear deterrent against North Korea, but it also gives them more strategic autonomy because it, again, as you said, allows them to resist Chinese influence within the region and make them less dependent on the United States and perhaps Japan. So that's absolutely right. In the Japanese context, the former and late Prime Minister Shinzo Abe he made a statement that we should start the discussions about starting the discussions about having discussions about acquiring a nuclear deterrent. That's actually the translation. So it is still a taboo topic. And this is why I think when we talk about acquiring a nuclear deterrent in Japan, really, that's not plan A, B, C, or D. It's plan Z. Japan's security, concept is strong U.S.-Japan alliance. Deepen that alliance, then have another layer through the quadrilateral security dialogue, building new strategic partners through reciprocal access agreements with the Philippines, Australia, the UK. Likely we're going to see more of those agreements this year. And then build more security layers through minilateral partnerships like we saw with the Philippines and Australia, Japan, and the US in terms of helping them deal with their maritime challenges. And then above that, there's all these layers of trade and economic agreements. So it's, as my friend Fukushima Akiko says from Aoyama University, it's like a lasagna. It's all these layers of creating a security architecture that are not just about deterrence, but about creating and de-incentivizing conflict and also anchoring different kinds of states within the region. And that's really important. And, you know, for Japan, the acquisition of a nuclear weapon, while there are some people that are discussing this, it really is a fringe idea in Japan because, you know, their unique history of really being the only countries that have experienced nuclear war, that's how they understand it. Their post-World War II myth is that, you know, they were victims of nuclear weapons. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why atomic weapons were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the reality is they were the first and second country and the last country that's experienced nuclear weapons. And they use this as a kind of national symbol of their rebirth, that they're wedded to pacifism, wedded to not using military power. But they face the conundrum today of an expansionist China, of an aggressive Russia, of a nuclear-armed North Korea, and, you know, a relative decline in U.S. power compared to the rise of China. And I don't mean that in a demeaning way. You know, back in 1991 and 92, the U.S. was the paramount power, by far. But today, China is a peer competitor in the Asia-Pacific, and only in the Asia-Pacific. That's because of geography.
Yeah. Well, it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break, so we'll do that. And when we come back, can you tell me, you know, so the Japanese historically had, you know, a militarist culture. And subsequent to World War II, they've really tried to eradicate that as a cultural element. And so I wonder, you know, and you talked about security as a lasagna and it's got all these layers and components to it. If that were to fail, would the Japanese be able to fight, and would they defend themselves? Would they join the U.S. in conflict? You know, because I could easily see, you know, Okinawa, Sasebo, Yokosuka, all of those key places being targeted by Chinese missile strikes. Or how would the Japanese, you know, deal with that kind of environment as opposed to building layers to protect it? Is there something behind the layers if the layers fail? So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Dr. Stephen Nagy, and he's been, you know, it's been a great discussion thus far on sort of getting a sense of how the Japanese see themselves and how they think about security, and from somebody who's lived across the region for three decades. So it's been a really interesting discussion. So I posed a question to you a minute ago, you know, how would the Japanese, if forced, how would they deal with that?
Well, they don't want to be forced into, you know, fighting anybody. Again, I think there's a deeply pacifist aspect to post-World War II Japan, in that its primary tools of dealing with conflict are diplomacy, overseas development aid, compromise, and again, working with the United States and countries with similar interests to try and de-incentivize aggressive states or expansive states from doing what they're doing. Would they fight alongside the United States? I think, Adam, it depends on what is the fight. If it's in the over the Philippines, I'm not so sure. If Okinawa was attacked, I think Japan would, you know, have to defend itself alongside the U.S. But it's a little bit more complicated than I think, you know, just do we fight with the U.S.? Remember, Japan has this pacifist constitution. It's called Article 9. It's given up the right to use force as an instrument of foreign policy. And even the recent security changes in Japan back in 2015, allowing for collective defense, are only that collective defense defending the U.S. is only under certain circumstances. So in a sense, I think President Trump's view that, you know, there's some incongruencies with the U.S.'s commitment to defending Japan and vice versa, and that this needs to be more ironed out. But fortunately, I think Japanese political leaders and those in the security establishment understand these problems and they're trying to work through it, but they need to get the public on that side. And I think, you know, Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, North Korea's launching of ICBMs, and of course China's assertive behavior across the Taiwan Strait, in and around the Senkaku Islands, and its assertive behavior in the South China Sea has all been fuel for the fire, I think, in terms of making Japanese people understand how serious security concerns are. And as a result, back in 2022, the new National Security Strategy, which is now an old National Security Strategy, committed to doubling defense spending by 2027 to 2% of GDP, which is a lot if you're thinking about Japan. That's about $100 to $120 billion. It still pales in comparison to China, that's spending about $250 billion a year, at least. We that's the official numbers. But still, it's a big jump from the Japanese perspective.
So, if you have a new book, and in that book you talk about a lot of these security issues, and we've sort of had a nice conversation thus far, but what is the title of your book when's it expected to be released? And then my third question, most importantly, is what are we missing in our discussion that's an important component of the new book?
Great. So the book's title is Navigating U.S.-China Strategic Competition, Japan's International Adapter Middle Power State or Approach. And I guess the key is that, you know, Japan has to, you know, its comprehensive and most important partner, bar none, is the United States. And we often think about U.S.-Japan relations through the lens of World War II. But if you look at it over the past 170 years, this relationship is strong, robust, deep. I mean, there's deep, deep cooperation in the area of military, diplomacy, education, science. It's very, very deep. And then there's China, and that's a really important economic partner. And of course, Japan, some of its cultural traditions came from China and then highly localized in the Japanese context. So it's a complex relationship, and they have to balance and navigate this. So how does it do it? And this is where this international adapter middle power comes in. You know, you've traveled to Europe, right? You need to have an adapter for your Yep. for your devices. And that's what Japan does in many ways. So, you know, it serves as a bridge, as a connector. It's allowing the Vietnamese and the Americans to work together through Japan. It's allowing the Philippines and Japan and Australia to work together. So it connects and it adapts different kinds of states, and not like-minded states, but different kinds of states. And that's actually really important when we think about the broader Indo-Pacific region. It's very heterogeneous politically, in terms of the economy, in terms of development. There's socialist states, there's democratic states, there's soft authoritarian states. There are island political entities like Taiwan. And you can't just say, I have to work with liberal democracies. If that's your approach, you don't have any friends, right? You're going to alienate people. So Japan, it has this really interesting approach where it serves to connect different states, and it does this in the security realm, it does it in the infrastructure connectivity realm, it does it in terms of trade, it does it in terms of diplomacy, and most recently, over the past 4 or 5 years, it's done it in the area of technology. And I guess that's the big take home of the book, is that if you want to be an effective player in the region, you can't just work with democracies, you have to work with a whole group of states. It's kind of like going to the Star Wars canteen, right? You got to work with all those different aliens if you want to play the poker game. It's not just, you know, work with the people that look like you. And that's Japan's middle power status. That's its superpower in many ways. It allows different kinds of states, different states with different political identities to work together. And that's generally, you know, the book's content, is understanding how Japan serves in those different areas as a connector, an adapter, a bridge maker.
Now, it's that time in the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, Bob, of course, grants all of NucleCast's guests 3 wishes. He only stipulates that the wishes have to be in relation to the topics we've been discussing. So no great wealth, no youth, none of that. Just wishes related to our topic. So with that in mind, let me ask you, what is your first wish?
I'd like to see the United States commit to some kind of trade agreement, so it's anchored in the region, not just through security partnerships, not just through diplomatic partnerships, but through an economic partnership that allows it to work with Japan and Australia, Singapore, to build the next set of trade rules that will help recalibrate global trade. So I think that's one of my big wishes. And I think, you know, when the United States withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership again, I think it was an unfortunate decision. And as many, I think, military leaders said, you know, that was like having 2 aircraft carriers in the region. The trade agreement is really, really important. And this is something that I hope we'll see emerge in the coming years. United States is anchored into the region through some kind of trade agreement.
Yeah, that's a solid wish. I think Bob's probably going to agree to that one. Okay, so that's wish number one. How about wish number two?
This is a tough one, and you know, this is not so much on the U.S. side, but it's coming from the U.S. side. I'd like to see not only Japan and South Korea, Australia and Canada, but European countries fundamentally increase their defense spending and have a more realistic view about the security challenges within the region, drop some of the environmental extremism, and focus on deregulating. And, you know, I'm saying this in this way because I think these have been long-term asks by the United States. Whether it was a President Harris or a President Trump, they would have made the same requests. But I think that this is really, really important in terms of helping a collective group of countries have the economic, diplomatic, technological, and defense capabilities to outcompete authoritarian states that really want to fundamentally change how our international institutions work. They want to move towards a sphere of influence, understanding of international affairs, and they want to ensure that a might is right Machiavellian approach to global affairs is how we function. And, you know, for the U.S., this is not so bad, but for Canada, where I'm from, or Japan, where I live, or South Korea, or Singapore, this is a nightmare. It will bring instability. So that's my second wish. You know, forget the noise that comes out of the White House and listen to the requests and try to, again, to spend more and deregulate and be more realistic about the challenges that we're facing.
Yeah, that's another good one. So now you're down to your final wish.
That's a tough one. So I think we've moved into a space on the AI front. And AI and technology in general is, I think, the core of the U.S.-China strategic competition. Both understand that who leads, who will be the front runner of AI and quantum computing development will shape not only the 21st century's economy, but maybe the 22nd, 23rd, 24th, 25th. So my hope is that, again, working with the United States and Japan and South Korea and Canada and the EU, that they're able to come together and coordinate their development in AI and quantum computing so that they can win that competition and win that competition in a way that protects our values and our systems in a way that ensures that we can continue to have a rule of law-based international order that focuses on freedom, that focuses on democracy, that focuses on development, focuses on open societies. We can only do it by doing it together, and that means shared resources, opening up our research, and really understanding that the alternative is a closed system, a securitized system, a system where we lose our privacy, a system where the state really controls what we do, how we think, what we read. To me, this is a fundamental step back in terms of not only each of our countries' development, but I think a fundamental step back in how humans have improved their general development over the past 500 years.
All right. Stephen Nagy, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thanks so much, Adam.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpall. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.